Back at it here on Connecticut Today for Thursday, November 12th, we talked with a lawyer from the Landmark Legal Foundation who gave us his interpretation of Supreme Court arguments a few days earlier regarding the Affordable Care Act. And we gave you portions of the latest COVID-19 briefing from Governor Ned Lamont. Good to have you back. Thanks for joining us. And I understand you filed, an amicus brief in this case? Talk about that.
Right. So Landmark filed a brief in the latest case, California v. Texas, that kind of matched some of the arguments we made in the original case, which was NFIB versus Sebelius. And what we argued was that Chief Justice Roberts used an improper interpretation of the individual mandate as it relates to tax. So just to set the stage for everybody, this is a massive law right when it was first passed. The individual mandate is one part of the law that deals with private insurance markets and how it deals with individuals. Mm-hmm. There's another section that deals with Medicaid funding, and a third that has just a grab bag of miscellaneous things like when you go to a fast food restaurant now, there's nutritional information posted. But anyway, the individual mandate required everyone to buy health insurance, and if you failed to do so, you had to pay a penalty. In the original case, the argument from conservatives was that this was a violation of the Commerce Clause and was unconstitutional. And Chief Justice Roberts really surprised everybody by aligning with the liberals on the bench and said it was okay to do this because you could interpret this as a tax. And it hadn't really been approached as a tax until very late in the briefing. So what's changed since then? Well, in 2017, Congress amended the statute and zeroed out the tax. So the tax went from about $695 down to zero. So for those of us on the conservative side, we're arguing, hey, look, it's really hard to claim that this is within Congress's taxing power now because it's not a tax anymore. And the Chief Justice actually wrote that the essential feature of any tax is that it raises revenue for the government. So a tax set at zero really doesn't do that anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where we are now. And as you know, going into this case, everyone on the left was really trying to argue and inflame passions against Amy Coney Barrett that a vote for Barrett was going to be a lock on overturning the entire law and, you know, putting people out of their health insurance plans. And that was really just obviously an attempt to inflame passions and not to illuminate people.
Yes.
About the policy.
And Matt, so I guess this leads into, and you folks and other legal people I know have brought this up, the theory of severability in a law, the idea that, what is it, parts of a law can be either a strike completely or Congress can be urged to change that. Talk a little about that if you can.
Sure. And if I could actually go, like, because it'll make sense if I go to the end of it.
Sure.
Severability is like what happens at your final stage. But when you first go into court, there was like an initial hurdle for the plaintiffs in this case or the challengers to the law was whether or not they even have standing. And standing is a principle, meaning do you have the actual right to sue? Are you the right person to be here in court? And the Constitution requires that our court system, a federal court system, applied to cases and controversies. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be a live case, right? Like if a car hits my neighbor, that doesn't mean I get to sue on his behalf. There has to be some kind of injury linked to me. Okay. So, and in this case, standing is kind of complicated. There are some people who, individual plaintiffs, but then you also have some of the red states saying, hey, look, we have to print out some forms and we're harmed by this law. Because we have to monitor people's health insurance and use the income tax forms that you guys are all aware of when you're filing taxes. So there was kind of an administrative burden that they said was enough to get them into court. But speaking generally, you know, conservatives are a lot stricter about standing rules than liberal justices are. Liberals are much more likely to kind of have an expansive view on it and let people come into court and make novel claims. So there was that initial thing first before you even get going. And then when you get to the merits, that's kind of what I was addressing initially. When you get to the merits of the case, you had something that was, we were told was hey, this is a tax. It's not a regulatory command that mm-hmm. would be implicated by the Commerce Clause. But the original statute, you know, it has the command mandating to buy health insurance and a separate part that says you're going to pay a penalty.
Yeah.
And once we've removed the penalty, so all of a sudden what's left is this naked command to most Americans saying you shall buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, Justice Breyer and people who are supporting the law say, well, you know, there are lots of things that Congress passes that encourage us to do things. And they raise, for an example, like the flag code, telling you how you should handle an American flag.
Yeah.
Our answer to that, though, is the language used in that is you should hold the flag in a certain way. It's not as mandatory. And you know, I know I'm kind of nerding out for...
No, I understand. No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
So, you know, and for your listeners, you know, like little distinctions like that can be very crucial when judges are interpreting a law, like a word that's permissive as should as opposed to shall. So those of us on the right are saying, hey, look, what's left now, even based on what the original case said in NFIB versus Sebelius, is a command that violates the Commerce Clause. And so now we should move on and say that this is unconstitutional. And then you get to the final step that you address, and that's severability. So when you have a massive law, and like one of the justices, Kagan, mentioned this, right now Congress, they're passing these huge omnibus bills that have billions of dollars in spending and cover all these different topics, right? If you find one thing wrong with one of the statutes and say, hey, this section here is unconstitutional, how should judges respond to that?
Yeah.
What do they do?
Yeah.
And that's the issue of severability.
Matt, hang on. I want to come right back to you here. We've got to do traffic and weather together. But we are talking to Matt Voorhees from the Landmark Legal Foundation about what happened a few days ago at the Supreme Court. Matt, when we come back, I will ask you about what I guess was highlighted from a couple of justices and what we could tell, if anything, from the questioning and the oral arguments. Hang on, Matt Voorhees back with us in a moment from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Traffic and weather together on WICC. A couple of more minutes here on what is going on if you're having trouble figuring it out on the Supreme Court with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Maybe you are on the ACA. It's enrollment time here in Connecticut for our health exchange here, Access Health CT. Matt Voorhees joins us from the conservative Landmark Legal Foundation. So, Matt, what did you think of what you heard of the arguments a few days ago? And I understand that it was Justice Kavanaugh and at least one other justice, Matt, who may have given a little tip-off as to what the outcome might be by their questioning, correct?
You're exactly right. So there's an old saying for court watchers that you shouldn't take too much from what the justices asked during the oral arguments, because they could be, you know, trying to persuade one of the other justices about their side in a way that we don't quite understand. But you could not get a stronger signal from the oral arguments on this case that Brett Kavanaugh believes that the individual mandate can be severed from the whole law, and the whole law does not need to be struck down. And Justice Roberts, too, the Chief Justice, also made comments that strongly suggested that severability is really going to be the way they go, assuming they clear that initial standing hurdle and rule on the merits that the command is unconstitutional. So what this means is, you know, I circle back to the claim that got everyone afraid, like, hey, I'm going to be kicked off and I have pre-existing conditions. There was a slight risk of that, but not very many people thought that mm-hmm. the government was going to be successful in their argument and strike down the entire law, the entire ACA. Okay, and I have to remind everybody, in the initial case, NFIB versus Sebelius, they addressed some of the Medicaid funding part of that huge statute and said that was unconstitutional and did not throw out the entire ACA.
Yeah, I remember that. Matt, what did you get, if anything, from any questioning from Amy Coney Barrett? Because I believe this was her first oral argument. She was involved in this, right?
Yes, she was. And she was able to sit, and she actually had some pointed questions about standing. So there you go, completely defying the expectation that she was supposed to be this total zealot and ideologues who would just vote in lockstep.
Right-wing death ray, right?
right, which was really very silly.
Matt Forey's from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out, landmarklegal.org. Matt, thank you. Appreciate it, and we'll be in touch. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, so there you go, folks.
Scott Gottlieb, our great friend, our advisor, Connecticut's very own, former head of the Food and Drug Administration, and on the board of Pfizer. As you remember from our meeting on Monday, Pfizer's first out of the box with a vaccine that could be a game changer. Before we're there for questions, let me just give you a quick summary of where we are. What's interesting here, 24,000 tests, we're running at a rate of 200,000. Given the ramp up in infections around the country and in our state, we're bringing in the reinforcements. What we can do in terms of testing, we're in the top five in the country, and we're gonna keep that up. And 98% of everybody who gets tested, we're getting results within a day or so. We're able to track and trace about 98% of them, which is pretty good, but it's not good enough, and we're still working really hard to keep up. The positivity rate of 4.8%, we've been bouncing around a little bit, but you know it's trending up. The seven-day average is 4.4%, so it gives you an idea of what the trend is like. Hospitalizations, 33. That's a number I'm watching carefully. We've doubled the number of people in hospital related to COVID in the last 2 weeks. 617, you see right now. Less likely to be in the ICU, the intensive care units, more likely to be in the hospitals. As I've explained before, we're able to expand capacity of our hospitals, build up those field hospitals. Our amazing Connecticut Guard, we can do that within 48 hours. Working really hard on nurses and other specialists to make sure we have the backup, because that could be a real need. We've seen that around the country. Last time around, we could bring in nurses and specialists from elsewhere. There is no elsewhere right now. Let me take the next chart. You can see the red alert status is true of about 100 of our 169 towns. That's about 80% of our population. What's the good news there? Eastern Connecticut's doing a little bit better. New London and Groton bringing in the reinforcements. They brought down the positivity rate there a little bit. That's a positive. If you're in Roxbury or Scotland or Sharon, you're in the white. There's not many, but go to ct.gov. You can see if you happen to be in one of those low infection areas, but there's not many. I'm afraid that Bridgeport is probably the area that's being hardest hit right now in terms of the infection rate. And this is why we're using our protocols on a statewide basis. It's a statewide issue, and we're working closely with our neighbors, as I'll explain in 1 minute. What else can we do? We explained in the next chart the COVID alert. And right now, our track and trace is if you test positive, we'll reach out, find out who else you've been in contact with. It's a way, if you tell us, that we can keep your friends and family safe and narrow the spread. The COVID alert is a smartphone applications. You heard Josh talk about that probably a month ago. We've been out there testing it in our colleges right now. It's a smartphone app, and it provides immediate notification if you've been near someone who has tested positive in the last 14 days. We're the first in New England to do this. Some of our states, like New York, have been doing this for a while. We wanted to learn from their example. Completely anonymous. Completely anonymous. You'll be notified on an anonymous basis. I think that's really important to give you confidence that you want to download this app. And if you do get alert that you've been in contact with somebody, you'll get instructions on testing, quarantine, where you can get tested, and reach out to a contact tracer, or they'll reach out to you to get a little more information from you. So how do you do it? That's on the next chart. All right, for Apple users, it's not that tough. I mean, Even I could do it. So that tells you something. You know, on your iPhone, you go to the settings and go to exposure notifications. Right there, you can get that downloaded in 1 minute. If you have your iPhone, go to settings, go to exposure notifications right now. And same thing on for the Android users, go to the COVID Alert CT app. It's part of Google Play. I urge you to do this. I urge you to do it now. It is exponentially more effective if each and every one of you, download this app. If only 5% of your friends do it, you're not going to be noticed. If 90% of your friends do it, you're that much safer. That's why we're urging you to do this. We've been testing this in some of our colleges over the last couple weeks. It's working. The next chart. It's 14 days to Thanksgiving. We knew that November was going to be a tough, complicated month. We knew it was complicated because of lines and elections. We knew it was complicated because of flu season. We know it's complicated because of Thanksgiving and the holidays. And I need you to be cautious a little bit longer. You know, first and foremost, all of our colleges, we're giving them the protocols. Please test before you get on that plane, quarantine before you head back to wherever you're from. And I urge the same thing for each and every one of the colleges and our kids coming from elsewhere. Paul is working very closely with our neighboring states, setting out clear protocols to all those colleges. This is what you want to do. I'm also looking at this demographically. People over the age of 60, stay safe, stay at home. I know you heard that before. You're going to hear it again. It's by far the safest thing for you and your family. We're going to talk to the supermarkets, maybe give an extra hour so you can go and shop safely at a special time, because some of those are getting quite crowded right now. 10-person gatherings. I know that's tough for Thanksgiving. And in a few minutes, I'll tell you a little bit about some of our protocols when it comes to schools. But first, let's take your questions, unless, Scott, you'd like to say something first.
No, Governor, I welcome the questions. I just turned on the COVID alert, so I'm now part of the contact tracing.
Wasn't that tough, was it?
You're right, it was quite easy.
All right, Max.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, a question about testing. You know, we are seeing a lot more testing, but along with the spike in cases, we're hearing that in some places there are now wait times or instances where people are needing to wait days to get tested. Is the state aware of these issues, and how widespread is this?
Why don't you take that, Josh?
Yeah, we are aware. Despite, as the governor mentioned, you know, we're running over 200,000 tests a week, which makes us top five in the nation in testing per capita. We have seen a surge over the last few days, and we are seeing some lines at certain testing sites. So we're taking a lot of actions. We've been working with our testing partners. We've actually added 30 new testing sites over the last 2 weeks. We're well over 200 testing sites around the state. We're increasing the hours that they're open. We're increasing, making sure that they have coverage on weekends as well. We're also helping them expand, both with financial supports from the state as well as staffing. We're deploying 50 National Guard members to help deal with some short-term staffing crunches in a couple of sites. So we're moving very aggressively on that, and we look to get those lines down quickly. The bottleneck is really at sample collection. It's not in the laboratories. We have plenty of laboratory capacity. It's really getting people swabbed, getting those samples off to the lab. So we're working to expand that even faster.
Perfect. Got it. A real quick question for Dr. Gottlieb about the travel advisory, because for the first time ever, when we're looking at the COVID exit strategy map, nearly every state is in that deep red, uncontrolled spread category. So the question is, you know, if we're all in this uncontrolled spread, are the health risks for people, you know, traveling home from college or people traveling for Thanksgiving, is the risk as great as it would have been if there were still pockets of the country that were doing well?
I think the risk is greater right now because we have a situation right now. I mean, the Northeast is doing well relative to other parts of the country, but we have a situation right now where we have a lot of spread everywhere across the country. We always worry that as we entered the fall and winter, we would see a more confluent epidemic. What we've had so far is regionalized epidemics. The first epidemic was largely centered in the Northeast. Then we saw a wave of infection sweep the South. Now what we're seeing is a truly national epidemic where every part of the country is going to be simultaneously engulfed in infection. It started in the Midwest. It sort of transferred to the Great Lakes region. But now when you look across the nation, you see a fair degree of spread everywhere in certain states that are really hard pressed right now, a lot like the flu season. The flu season typically starts as a very regionalized epidemic, and then eventually it becomes a more confluent epidemic across the whole United States as the flu season progresses. That's what we're likely to see with coronavirus right now, a very difficult 2 or 3 months. You know, I'll just make sort of one final point. This is really the sort of eighth inning, if you will. I think this is the final stage of the acute phase of this pandemic that we need to get through. Unfortunately, it's going to be the hardest phase right now. We're in for a very difficult 2 or 3 months. We always thought that the fall and the winter would be the most difficult period with this virus. This is a respiratory pathogen that would typically spread in the wintertime. Now we're in that winter. We've taken steps to, you know, return to school, go back to college, go back to work. We're huddling indoors because it's cold out. So all the things we're doing is going to be conducive to that spread. We will get through this. And I think as we enter 2021, we're going to have a lot broader technology to try to mitigate this risk. I think 2021 is going to look a lot different than 2020 did. But we just need to try to, you know, take collective action and do as much as we can to try to slow the spread, preserve the healthcare system, and preserve life over what's going to be a very difficult 2 or 3 months, the final stages of the acute phase of this pandemic.
Perfect. The final one for me is just a clarification of the suspension of interstate sports. We know that teams cannot cross borders to play, but does this apply to specific players? For instance, a player lives in Springfield, Mass., but plays for an Enfield team. Is that still allowed?
Yeah, I'll take that question. Basically, how this applies, remember, this one is particularly for hockey, even though the state of Connecticut has put forth for all sports that we will limit our teams or teams of any sports in the state going to play tournaments outside the state, and also limited that there will be no out-of-state tournaments, basically teams from out of the state playing in the state. So basically, this means if you play the sport of hockey, for example, and there's a tournament that's occurring in Springfield, Massachusetts, you will be staying in the state of Connecticut, as Massachusetts also will not allow that team into the state to play hockey.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. On March 30th, our hospitalization rate was 517. That's 100 less people than it is today. Of course, you know, we were shutting down at that time. Why aren't we shutting down now, other than the fact that it would be fairly unpopular to do so? Why aren't we shutting down non-essential businesses and schools again just to get our numbers back to where they need to be?
I think we're finding that workplace, stores, we can manage those and keep them open safely. Although I am hearing stories about some of the grocery stores are getting pretty crowded, and we got to monitor the people there very carefully. As we said before, most of the spread is related more to the social interactions, but your point is well taken. Those, as the spread moves more to the community, it may impact some of those places that were not spreaders before. We're watching that very carefully with hospitalizations as a key metric.
And secondly, how long are you going to give the rollback to work, the one that you put in place last Friday, before you go into the next step? And what are your contingency plans? I mean, what is the warning you have for people who don't want to wear masks, who don't want to avoid social gatherings, about what you're going to do next if these numbers continue to rise?
It's not a warning. It's you've got to wear that mask. If you're inside, you can't social distance. You're in a public place. You're in a store. You must wear that mask, or you are subject to a fine. In terms of contingencies, look, we're watching very carefully. We've got the infections, for example, in our schools have gone up over the last week. We're following that pretty closely. much less so for in-classroom education, but much more so for students more broadly. I'm noticing when I look at schools, because that would probably be something we want to keep open as long as we can. I'm looking at Europe and other places where they've successfully kept their schools open despite much higher positivity rates. But you're right about, also I look at those other places, they had to do things with restaurants and fitness centers, and we're going to be watching that carefully. May have to make some changes if this curve doesn't bend.